workshop is on ultra high energy cosmic rays, neutrinos, and gamma rays. And in fact, we're splitting up the topics with Ellie. I'll start with a discussion of the ultra high energy gamma rays, which happens to be an area where there is a lot more recent observations. And then I'll briefly review the TV energies and above. And then I'll briefly review some very recent results from SWIFT, which is at lower energy photons, but it also has some very interesting new results which will be relevant for the ultra-high energy sources we discuss. And Ellie then will discuss ultra-high energy neutrinos, TV and above, and cosmic rays up to GZK energies, on which there are a number of new installations that are being constructed. TV gamma ray astronomy has undergone a lot of expansion recently. A number of telescopes have been built, which are generally sensitive in the range above 100 GeV. Now, the range of the GeV has generally been the province of space observations. On the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, there was an experiment called EGRET, which was sensitive. It measured several sources, gamma ray bursts in particular, up to something like 17 GeV, and then it also measured a large number of BLACs, AGNs whose jet is pointed more or less at the observer. GLASS, of course, is being built now and is due to be launched in 2006 going into 2007. The large area detector on GLASS will be sensitive up to 300 GeV, and it will greatly expand our horizons there. From the ground, since the gamma rays are absorbed in the atmosphere from the ground, one generally tries to do Cherenkov detectors. There is the water Cherenkov detector Milagro at Los Alamos, which has Milagrito's prototype has already had some interesting measurements. Milagro should be sensitive above 20 GeV. It's a football field size tank of water, a depth of about 3 meters or so, and has PMTs that look at the Cherenkov light. And then there have been a number of air Cherenkov telescopes that have built on previous generations, like Hazara Park and Whipple and so on. So the latest instruments that have been built are in the United States Veritas, which is in Arizona, and currently has one 12-meter dish with PMTs at the focus, and so the gamma rays penetrate the atmosphere and make a cascade in the upper atmosphere, which then produces Cherenkov light, which is measured by the phototubes. Sensitivity is expected for Veritas to be above 50 GeV, although currently it's probably more in the 100 GeV range. And a second telescope is expected to be installed next year. Ultimately, it should be up to 4. There has been another telescope already operating called Kangaroo, which is a Japanese-Australian collaboration, and that has 4 times 10 meters and a sensitivity threshold above 50 GeV. And then a large 17-meter single dish called MAGIC in La Palma, run by Munich and a consortium of other universities. And that is more ambitious. It tries with the larger detecting areas, trying to get the sensitivity down to 30 GeV. So these will be very good. In general, they're more sensitive above GeVs, but to get an overlap with the space-based detectors would be great. Glass, of course, is sensitive from 20 MeV up to 300 GeV, so it cannot get up to TeV, but on the high energy range, it might overlap with the low energy range of the ground-based air-sharing-off telescopes. And then by far the most exciting results have come from a serial air-sharing-off system called HESS, which is run largely by Heidelberg Max Planck Institute, but a consortium of universities are involved in that. That's in Namibia and South Africa, so it's some of them are in the southern hemisphere. Veritas is in the northern hemisphere. Kangaroo is also southern hemisphere. There are a number of interesting sources in the southern hemisphere because the galactic plane can be seen from the southern hemisphere, but not so much from the northern hemisphere. So the chance of galactic sources being visible there is higher. HESS consists of four 12-meter telescopes, and the sensitivity has been operating since 2004 with the four telescopes built, and it has currently the sensitivity is 100 GeV, but it aims to get down to about 50 GeV. And over the last year, it has been producing a number of very exciting results.
I
wasn't saying anything sensitive, just taking my sweater off. So for instance, whereas Whipple in 1989, this was one of the first Air-Cherenkov telescopes that pioneered a lot of observations, whereas Whipple detected the Crab Nebula in 50 hours of observing time, Hegra, another intermediate telescope in 97, detected the Crab in 15 minutes, and HESS now detects it in 30 seconds. So the sensitivity improvement has been tremendous. HESS has observed a number of sources, has observed a number of AGNs, including M87 and some well-known quasars, a starburst galaxy, NGC 253, several of the Parkes radio sources, which are quasars or BLACs, the galactic center, the Sagittarius A source, then some X-ray binaries like SENEX-3 and so on, and a lot of supernova remnants, including Vela, RxJ-1713, etc., and several unidentified TV sources, which it's quite interesting. You have now some TV photon sources which you haven't seen in any other wavelength, and you know we are not trying to see what they are. They are likely to be supernova remnants, but we don't know for sure. EGRET, I should say, these space detector, which was really a spark chamber on the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, had a list of 30 unidentified GeV sources. Now we're finding unidentified TeV sources. One of the very interesting observations of HESS was the observation of the galactic center. Whipple had detected the galactic center at 3.7 sigma. At TV energies, and then Kangaroo in 2002 detected it at 10 sigma, and now HESS detects it at, 50, 60 sigma or more. The spectrum, for instance, that Kangaroo had detected was a somewhat softer spectrum than 2.2, and it had a cutoff at 2 TeV. And that caused a lot of excitement. It was a diffuse source. It caused a lot of excitement because with a 2 TeV cutoff, it would have been compatible with WIMP, let's say neutralino annihilations, because WIMP masses up to 2 TeV are considered in models. The detection by Hess is, on the other hand, it shows a harder spectrum. It's flatter than the kangaroo spectrum, and it extends up to about 12 dB, and that, unfortunately, as I understand, is more difficult for wind models to satisfy. So it's good and bad. You know, you sort of may have to look at a more conventional explanation, and you know, particle acceleration leading to TV, certainly in an astrophysical source, is quite plausible. It so happens that Hess is so sensitive now that, and it has such good resolution, that it can actually image the diffuse source at the galactic center in TV gamma rays. And, you know, I cannot show pictures, but there will be talks during the mini workshop. The interesting thing is that, you know, you sort of, so you see these diffuse patches of TV emission with hotspots. And the TV hotspots, they superpose quite well on the X-ray hotspots that were known previously. And so included in the central blob with various hotspots is the galactic center Sagittarius A star, you know, the black hole source. And also within the error bars is a supernova remnant, supernova remnant Sagittarius A east. So, you know, it could be that these 12 TV power law is due to acceleration from shocks, accretion on the central black hole, or it could be that it's the supernova remnant, which in its expansion is accelerating cosmic rays. Supernova remnants are thought to accelerate the cosmic rays up to 10 to the 15 electron volts at least. So these cosmic rays or electrons accelerated by the supernova remnant or the galactic center could be the explanation for this source. Another interesting source that was detected is one that had been detected by Kangaroo previously. It's a supernova remnant called RxJ1737-3946. I'm sorry, I mean, this is a blackboard lunch, but I'm just talking. Is that okay, or shall I write things down? It's a very blackboard. So RxJ1737-1713.7, it's a bunch of numbers, is a southern supernova remnant. And it's a it has a resolved morphology. So in TV you can actually resolve it and get you know, again, a structure with hotspots and so on. Spectral index of 2.2. And so the interesting thing here is that, well, I should make some drawings. There is a structure which shows you know, there is an X-ray emission. And then there is, so that X-ray is thought to be synchrotron radiation from electrons accelerating the supernova. Then there was some egret observation, this old spacecraft observation in the GV range. And then there are the TV, there is the TV sort of detections here by Kangaroo. And now by Hess. And these peak here, so where Z is thought to be synchrotron, in a leptonic model, one would say that these inverse Compton electrons, the relativistic electrons, upscatter the same electrons that produce the synchrotron radiation, upscatter the synchrotron photons up to the TV range. And these electrons, by now the scattering is in the Klein-Nishina regime, so you're sort of pushing the upper edge of how far up you can go. And so it depends a little bit on how far up you go and what the slope is. The claim of the Kangaroo group was that these may have been the first indication that these may actually have been not inverse Compton, but pi not decay, therefore evidence, the first evidence for hadronic acceleration, direct evidence for hadronic acceleration in cosmic rays. of course, we observe cosmic rays, and so we infer or we think that they're supernova remnants, but these would have been a smoking gun signature that, you know, we have pionic decay in a supernova remnant, therefore we have, you know, proof that, that cosmic rays are accelerated in supernova remnants. And Hess has gone on and improved on the detection of Kangaroo. And it also is compatible with pionic decay. Inverse Compton seems to be, the inverse Compton explanation is a little bit, it cannot be ruled out, but it's a little bit on the iffy side, in the sense that you get a good inverse Compton fit if you assume a low magnetic field in the supernova remnant. Now, the supernova remnants that have been imaged in X-ray, generally show something like a contact discontinuity, and then there is a forward shock, and then there is, you know, a reverse shock, that's the ejecta. And these region here, the forward, between the forward shock and the contact discontinuity is rather narrow, which indicates that it has a high compression ratio. And so indirectly, one concludes that the reason these are so narrow is that protons have been accelerated in that region, and they have escaped the region, so that the region, you know, has less pressure by these escapes and sort of collapses in on itself. And that also would argue that you have an increased magnetic field. So, in fact, one suspects that here you should have a higher magnetic field. So if you have a high magnetic field, then you would sort of, there's a competition between synchrotron and inverse Compton. If you have high magnetic fields, then synchrotron radiation has a larger energy density. And so the inverse Compton losses, the ratio of inverse Compton losses to synchrotron losses is more or less the ratio of the photon density to the magnetic field density. So the inverse Compton would win. So the interpretation of whether this is hadronic or inverse Compton is still arguable. So there is good evidence for pionic decay, but it's not conclusive.
If you assume it's hadronic,
yes,
and you do the balance sheet,
mm-hmm,
how much of the cosmic rays can you get from the hadronic acceleration?
In the supernova remnants, I think you can get essentially all of them up to 10 to the 15 electron volts. So the energy density in supernova remnants is quite sufficient for that. No, it seems difficult to accelerate in supernova remnants cosmic rays above about 10 to the 16 or so. So the GZK ones are likely to be actually an extragalactic component, or you have to argue that there are other sources. There is between the GZK and the 10 to the 15 electron volt, some fits of the cosmic ray spectrum require an even a third wave component in between, but you know, that's there. The GZKs are almost certainly extragalactic, and gamma ray bursts and the AGNs are candidates. Ellie will discuss that. Okay, so let me move on to lower energy gamma rays. I promised I was going to say something about SWIFT. SWIFT is a spacecraft that was launched in November 20, I believe, and it has three instruments. One is a gamma ray large angle detector, which is sensitive in the range from 15 keV to 150 keV. So it's soft gamma rays, but wide angle. Then it has an X-ray telescope, and it has an ultraviolet optical telescope. And the nice thing about SWIFT is that it's designed so it can swivel almost in less than a minute to the position of a burst. So the wide-angle gamma ray detector locates a burst, and then the higher resolution X-ray and optical telescope, which, you know, were not pointed at it originally, can be made to point at it in less than a minute. So you can acquire a few arc second position in less than a minute, and you transmit it down to the ground via communication satellites in, you know, so in less than a minute you can spread out through the internet the notice that, you know, here's a location within a few arc seconds. And this has been used successfully to locate gamma ray bursts. Now, SWIFT has detected since December something like 38 bursts, of which 28 have had an X-ray position, a quick X-ray position. And there have been 14 optical transients measured with the onboard UVOT detector. And based on that, there have been 7 redshifts. And the interesting thing about that is that, you know, the burst alert telescope, the gamma ray detector, is that it's 5 times more sensitive than the previous successful BATSE detector on the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory. So you expect to see sources which are a little bit fainter. And in fact, the redshifts confirm that. The redshifts, the median redshift tends to be almost twice as high as the median redshift of the BATSE sources. So the highest one so far is 4.3. It's not the largest, but it's the second largest so far detected. And so on average, the median redshift is larger than 2. The BATSE median redshift was about 1. As a result, also, so, you know, every detector detects sources near the threshold. So on average, it's detecting fainter sources. And the X-ray afterglows and the optical afterglows are correspondingly fainter. So the optical ones in particular have been harder to detect. But they have been detected. And there have been a number of interesting new results. So for instance, now we have for the first time quick X-ray afterglows within 100 seconds of the trigger. Previously we had to wait something like 4 hours for the you know, BepoSat satellite to slowly move on, or Chandra slowly, to 8 hours, you know, before you could upload a command. Here it's autonomous. In the software, you know, it immediately swivels as soon as a burst goes. So for instance, one of the interesting things in the X-ray light curves has been that here's the trigger gamma rays. And then in X-rays, here at about 100 seconds, now we change wavelengths, one sees, for instance, a very steep decay previously not seen. So something like a slope that F of EX is proportional to EX to the minus 2.2. And previously, you know, such steep decays haven't been seen. Then it flattens to a more usual slope of minus 1.2 or minus 1.1 and so on, after, let's say, 300 seconds.
Peter, are you giving us the spectral slope or the time slope?
This is the time slope, sorry. Okay. Right. So the spectral slope here is also rather steep. And here is ascribed to the normal forward shock emission. This has caused some puzzlement as to what that could be, whether it's, you know, it could be that one is seeing a very narrow jet, and then there is a jet break here, but these would have been a very early jet break in the technical jargon. I don't want to go into details. Other possibilities are that it's a reverse shock being seen in X-rays, or that one is seeing high latitude emission. This is something that I probably don't want to go into details. Another observation has been to see, you know, after the gamma ray phase, here at a few hundred seconds, let's say 300 seconds, to actually see a peak before something like this, so a rather sharp flare, and then some bumps. And the steepness of the flare has been, is also rather new. So these are rises of something like, depending on where puts the time origin, it's a rise of 2.5 and decays of 3.5 or steeper. And the interpretation of these is it could be that it's late internal shocks.
These are one tenth of what's the range?
Yeah, yeah. They are not X-ray flashes because they had been detected in gamma rays previously. Okay, so it's not soft spectrum source, but it's the X-ray, you know, measurement
right.
of you know.
And of one the of these, I mean, there was this question of these X-ray flashes that have been seen in other telescopes.
That's right. So one or two of the sources detected by SWIFT are classified as X-ray flashes in the sense that their spectrum is softer and it's mainly in the X-rays. But this kind of behavior is seen also on traditional gamma ray bursts, which have a hard gamma ray spectrum in the beginning. And after that hard gamma ray phase is over, then you have these X-ray behavior. So these wouldn't be classified as X-ray flashes. You know,
but
for
if
instance,
you just had a 10-kilovolt instrument,
yeah.
The only thing you'd see would be this.
That's right, okay. That's right, yeah. But you did have the gamma ray instrument, so you
right,
know
right,
that
I
it.
Understand.
Yeah. So one of the other possibilities that arises with. In gamma ray bursts is that one is trying there to detect a hadronic signal. SWIFT is not going to be able to detect hadronic signals because the hardest energy it gets up to is 150 kV. There have been some indications or some hints of hadronic origin gamma rays with previous instruments, so for instance with EGRET. There was one burst in 1994, which had a very hard emission in the 200 MeV range and above. And again, you know that one could interpret that as a hadronic cascade. But again, it wasn't a smoking gun because alternative explanations based on inverse Compton could reproduce it. The problem with, of course, these hadronic interferences, you need a good spectrum. So GLAST is the instrument there that we hope will tell us something about that. Gamma ray bursts in the TeV range are very hard because they would have to be very close. Otherwise, the TeV gamma rays are absorbed by the infrared background in the intergalactic medium. There have been a few reports of TV detections at the 3 sigma level of gamma ray bursts by the Grand Array and by the Tibet Array, but you know at 3 sigma levels you cannot say much. Okay, so I think I'm ready to have Ellie talk about cosmic rays.
I have one more question.
Yes.
The supernova ray shows that it has a peak around the redshift 1. Now, SWIFT is seeing a median redshift for the GLB is around 1.5 than that. So if GLB and supernova are connected, can I say something about this redshift?
Well, the supernova are barely detected above redshift 1, but the star formation rate has a peak that is around 2.5, and then it flattens off. So that star formation rate at 2.5 would be compatible with the Swift median redshift being at 2. That should be okay.
So I'm going to discuss the the other particles. So Peter was discussing the photons, and now we'll discuss the rest. And I'll try to give you some feeling for what the interesting questions are and some orders of magnitude so that you can go out and invent your own models. So I'll discuss the high energy cosmic rays and neutrinos. Okay. I'll start with the highest energies that Peter already mentioned. We know that there are 10 to the 20 electron volt particles out there. So we see particle showers in the atmosphere. Which are generated by something that hits the atmosphere and starts off with 10 to the 20 electron volt energy. The rate of such events is very low, roughly 1 per 100 kilometers square year. Okay, so they're extremely rare. And the experiments that we had so far were roughly 50 kilometers square effective area or so, operating over 10 years. So you see immediately that we have a handful of events. So we are quite certain that they are there, and we know that their energies exceed 10 to the 20 electron volts, but we have very little information because we have very few particles. So we have several problems. One, we don't have a good spectrum with a handful of particles. We cannot get a good energy spectrum. We don't know what the composition, or let's say the primary identity. So we do not measure these particles directly. We just see the showers that produce in the atmosphere. And so it's very difficult to determine what is the particle that actually initiates this shower. We have some evidence that there are not gamma rays. So they are presumably nuclei, and maybe I'll, in parentheses, say light nuclei. We have some evidence, I think, that they are light, but it's not certain. And the last point about these observations, we measured the arrival direction of these particles within a few degrees. Okay. And if you look at the sky, at some air box of a few degrees, you find everything there. So any type of object that you can imagine is there. So we cannot associate these particles and with any particular source. Moreover, if they are charged particles, they would be deflected by magnetic fields on the way. So in any case, we would not be able to associate it with any source. Yeah.
What's the evidence that those are light nuclei? Can you summarize it?
Well, there are two types of evidence, well, three. The depth at which the shower develops in the atmosphere depends on the primary. So if there are gamma rays, they could interact with an electric field very high up. If they are light nuclei, they penetrate more than if they are heavy nuclei. So this is one line of evidence. The other is the ratio of muon and electrons in the showers. So heavier nuclei would have higher muon fraction than light ones. And the last thing is to do with the temporal structure of the showers that hits the ground. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they're different, but these are all very, very uncertain. My personal view is that the evidence is slightly in favor of the light nuclei. They are probably not gamma rays.
But heavy nuclei are certainly a possibility.
Yeah, that's right. But they have also theoretical prejudice, so uh-huh. They cannot be heavy nuclei.
How well are neutrinos ruled out as possible primaries?
Well, neutrinos with stardust interactions, you mean? Well, so neutrinos typically interact very deep in the atmosphere.
Sure.
So unless you invoke some unusual
cross-sections. So it's out of
question.
There can't be neutrinos.
Stardust interaction cross-sections.
New targets.
Just to be fair, Alan Watson gave this lovely talk arguing that they might be for a
10. So I don't want to be fair. Okay, so maybe I'll summarize just the things that you need to remember. Okay, so we have this 10 to the 20 electron volt showers. And we have a flux of roughly 1 per 100 kilometers per year. So we have the spectrum is not well determined. And we don't know what the primaries are. I would say light nuclei, in parentheses here. And we don't know what the sources are. This has something to do with the accuracy of this. Now, why is this interesting? I'll try to explain very quickly what is the challenge in producing such particles. Okay? So the way, if we look at the normal way we believe particles are accelerated in astrophysics, is by producing some potential drop and letting charged particles go down this potential drop. Okay? And if we have, let's say, suppose if we have some astrophysical source and it drives some outflow of magnetized plasma. This occurs in many cases, we think, at least. So we have some magnetic field here, and so the plasma carries some magnetic field and it extends with some characteristic velocity. Okay? Now, I'll put an imaginary wire here, okay? So I'll get this electromotive force produced. So the potential drop is 1 over c times the time derivative of the magnetic flux, which we can estimate as the magnetic flux itself is b times r squared, if r is the radius of this wire. And the characteristic time scale for variation, I would say it's r divided by the velocity. Okay, so we get v over c times b times r. This is roughly the potential that the source would produce. And this potential, say the, if we take, let's say, protons as the particles, so the charge times the potential needs to be larger than the energy of these particles that we see. Okay? And so this sets a lower limit to b times r, and therefore also a lower limit to the rate at which energy should be produced by the source, right? Because this plasma is flowing out, it carries some energy with it. At the minimum, it carries the magnetic field energy. So the luminosity is larger than the magnetic field energy density times the area times the velocity. Okay? So if we have a lower limit on b times r, we have a lower limit on the luminosity. So we have this is b times r squared times v, and b times r should be larger than e divided by beta e. Right? So this should be larger than the energy, and squared, right, beta c. So I use beta as v over c here. Okay? So we have here a simple expression. Okay, we have a lower limit to the energy generation rate. This gets slightly more complicated for relativistic sources, and we need to discuss relativistic sources because the relevant objects are probably relativistic. There's only one point in these relativistic objects, and this is due to the fact that the proton, if it starts going down this potential in a relativistic outflow, it doesn't have enough time to go around the circle. And we can understand this by, let's say, let's look at the plasma at radius r, and let us look at it then at radius 2r. The time that has elapsed, okay, in our frame is r divided by c. But if the plasma expands relativistically, then the time is contracted in the plasma frame by a factor gamma. So the rest frame time is r divided by gamma, this is the Lorentz factor, times c. So the proton in the rest frame, if it goes on this direction, would not go in the entire circle, it would go just 1 over gamma of the circle. So it would only utilize 1 over gamma of the potential, okay? So we'll have 1 over gamma here, and if we put these numbers here, we'll get this gamma squared here, okay? So for an optimized source, it would have gamma equals beta equals 1, roughly, but typically this is a large number. Now I just want to put the numbers here. So C, you know what it is. fine, probably you don't, but your physicist sees one. For astrophysicists, we want to know what the numbers are. So, 10 to the 20 electron volts is 1.6 times 10 to the 8 ergs, and the electron charge in the CGS unit is 4.8 times 10, and we square this. And you see this is 10 to the 18, 36, 35, 10 to the 45.5. So we have gamma squared over beta times 10 to the 45.5 ergs per second. And so to calibrate you, the standard luminosity is 10 to the 33 ergs per second. So I can write it as gamma squared over beta times 10 to the 12 solar luminosity. So obviously this is extremely impressive, and we don't have too many examples in the universe that can actually satisfy this condition, and this is basically the challenge of the acceleration, okay? So for this is an additional difficulty with the sources, okay? So we have this acceleration problem. So the sources must satisfy this. There are only two types of sources that we know of in the universe that can do this. One is gamma ray bursts. These are the objects that Peter just mentioned. They have Lorentz factors of a few hundred. Okay, so they should actually be something like 10 to the 16 solar luminosities, but this is okay because they are typically 10 to the 17 or 10 to the 18 solar luminosities. So this may be one source. So these are the GRBs. Okay, it's a gamma of 4 to the 10 to the 10 squared. The other type of source are active galactic nuclei. So these are different objects which produce fast luminous jets. They have gamma of 4 to the 10. Okay, so they don't need such high luminosities, but the problem is that the luminosities are much smaller than the gamma ray bursts. Maybe the brightest ones that we see, the brightest AGNs that we know, can get to this energy. Okay, so this is the first part of the challenge.
Are you assuming that a top-down scenario can't work, or is there evidence behind it? Is there a reason that you've thrown that out?
Okay, so this, my next sentence would have been, since there are only very few sources like this, suggestions have been made that maybe that these particles are not produced at all by the normal physics that we know and understand, and maybe you should involve some decay of topological defects and all sorts of heavy particles left over from the Big Bang that start off at gut scale and just decay to produce 10 to the 20 electron particles. Okay, I will not say more about this. Okay, now there's another problem. Which is this GZK problem. So let me just quickly explain what it is. So if these are protons, then protons can produce pions. So it's either P prime, prime zero or neutron prime plus. Okay? Interacting with photons. And the universe is filled with the microwave background, and the threshold for this interaction, okay, we need the proton energy times the photon energy to be larger than the product of the pion and proton mass in order to allow pion production. And so this is roughly 0.1 GeV squared, and the energy of the photons I'll take as 3 times the temperature of the CMB. The peak is at 3 times the temperature, right? So 3 times the CMB is 3 degrees Kelvin, which is 3 times 10 to the minus 4 electron volts. Okay? And so this is 10 to the 20. Okay? So protons at 10 to the 20 interact with this microwave background, they produce pions, and they lose energy. And we can estimate the distance that they can propagate. Okay? So we have 1 over the number of photons times the cross section. This would give us the mean free path. But each time we produce a pion here, the proton would lose m pi over mp of its energy. So it actually has to undergo several interactions, let's say 5. And in order to lose its energy. And then if we put the numbers, the number density of CMB photons, I'll tell you, is 400 per cubic centimeter. The cross section you should tell me. No more ideas. Okay, 10 to the minus 28 centimeters squared. And so this is roughly 10 to the 26 centimeters. So 10 to the 26 centimeters is a big distance, but it's very small on cosmological scale. Okay, so the Hubble distance to C times the Hubble time is roughly 10 to the 28 centimeters. So this is fairly nearby in terms of cosmology. And this is another problem because we don't have such objects which are so close to us, the AGNs, I mean. Okay? Okay. Now, from this...
So, I'll look at that. So naively, then, this is one reason why some might want to claim they're extremely heavy nucleon, right? It's just because then it's energy per nucleon.
But heavy nuclei can grow relative dissociation, so they will not survive either. Okay. The nuclei will be associated to lighter nuclei.
Understood, but the threshold energy is different. I mean, it's the energy per baryon that matters for your threshold here.
For the pion reduction, but not for dissociation.
That's
good. The dissociation is the energy is much, much lower. It's MeV energy, not GeV energy.
So you wash out heavy nuclei more quickly, or?
Yes, in principle, yes.
You
dissociate them faster. That's one of the reasons I'm inclined to think that they are like nuclei.
Yeah, I guess one is still in trouble. Yeah.
Well, I'm not. Okay, so I'll go very quickly on. So the one resolution. Immediately, I just want to show you one other number that if you put up your model, there's another number that you should get from your model. And based on this, we can estimate the rate at which energy should be put out into the universe by the sources, whatever they are. Okay, because you know that the flux is C times over 4 pi times the energy density, okay? And I've given you the flux here, so we can multiply, we can get the energy density. Now, the rate at which energy should be produced per unit volume is simply the energy density divided by the lifetime of these particles, okay? Which is this distance, d over C. So it's C times U divided by this d, and you see here c times u simply 4 pi j divided by d, and we have all the numbers, so we just put them in. This 4 pi j we said is 1 per square kilometer per year, 100 square kilometer per year, so I'll just write it as 1 per 10 to the 12 squared centimeter per year, and the distance we said is 10 to the 26, okay? And we need to multiply by the energy of a single particle, which is roughly 10 to the 8 ergs. So we get here 10 to the minus 30, right? Ergs per cubic centimeter per year. And astronomers usually measure things in megaparsecs. So megaparsec is 3 times 10 to the 24 centimeter. So I multiply this by this cube, so it would be 10 to the 43.5 ergs per megaparsec cube per year. Okay? So the source has to satisfy this, plus it should have an energy production rate of okay? So these are the numbers that we need to remember for these sources. Conveniently, GRBs produce gamma rays at roughly this rate. AGNs, I have no idea. Ask the people that support those models. Okay. Now, so, don't have much time, but let's say what's in this, in order to improve our understanding of the spectrum, the primary, and the nature of the sources, so you'd like to see a large amount of particles coming from some direction and so on, you need detectors which are much, much larger than what we used to have, and this is going to be supplied by the Roger foot. So this is the new cosmic ray experiment, which is being built. It's half, or a bit, almost half built. It would have 3,000 square kilometer exposure area, and it should be completed in the coming 2-3 years, and it will help us get a good spectrum. It would help a lot understanding the primaries, because it would have both a surface array and a nitrogen fluorescence detector, which would reduce the uncertainties in the models for developing the showers. And if the exposure is sufficiently large, it may identify individual sources of cosmic rays. Okay?
With what precision, though?
So it would have a similar accuracy in the angle, about 1 degree.
So how will it identify
the okay. Some models are predictions. For example, this model, because these are the bursting sources have some specific characteristic. They should have a narrow spectrum spread over some energy range and so on. So if you see a point source with this spread of energies and so on and so forth, you know that these are the sources. But I don't have time to go into all this detail. I want to go to the neutrinos, which are maybe solving all these problems from a different angle. Yeah. Unless there are other.
But also within the 1 degree squared, you wouldn't have many gamma ray bursts. They're rare enough that we'll probably be under one, and that.
But that's true, but you probably would not see it at all, because. Okay, so.
How much are the trajectories deflected by ambient magnetic fields then?
So we don't know the ambient magnetic field in the intergalactic medium, but we have upper limits from farther rotation measurements. So I think it's around, at most, around 10 degrees.
But that would wash out in your localization of the source.
It should be energy dependent. There should be some characteristics. If the source is spread by the magnetic field, there should be some characteristic distribution in angles and in energies and so on. So this is the thing that you would like to pick up from this experiment. It's not going to be trivial just looking at the point. Okay, so now we will use this.
Before this, there used to be some discussion of cosmic rays above the GCK.
Right.
Those have gone away?
No, so these are all above. So the 10 to the 20 is above the GCK. So,
it's sort of important.
Well, the highest energy is that we have seen. Okay. The point is the point. If you see, let's say, sources out to this distance, suppose that you have the sources just smoothly populating the universe, okay? The lower energy ones you see out to the edge of the universe, out to the Hubble distance, 10 to the 28. And these sources you only see up to 10 to the 26, so 100 times smaller distance. So the flux would be 100 times lower at this energy. So if you look at the cosmic ray spectrum, you should see a strong suppression. Okay, so this is the J cosmic ray function of energy. There should be some big drop here at 10 to the 20. Because here you see up to 10 to the 26, and here you see up to 10 to the 28. And now, this does not imply that there shouldn't be particles here. There should be, but at somewhat lower rate. Okay, so I would not call this a GCK cutoff. I would call it a suppression. And then the question is the flux field consistent or inconsistent with this suppression? And there's an argument going on. But as you can see there, from the handful of events, I think you cannot really determine this. You'll have to measure it and see whether or not. But the existence of these particles here in itself does not imply that there's a problem.
But that is an important distinction for a cosmological source.
Right.
If you really want everything to be cosmological, you must see such a phenomenon.
That's right.
Right. So there is a very strong prediction in these cosmological models as opposed to local models.
That's right.
You should see a huge jump.
Yes. And I think we already see it. But let's leave it to Roger to clear up. Yeah. So I really should move to neutrinos. You should tell me when I should stop. So, no one says anything. So the sources that these cosmic accelerators, we expect to also be producing neutrinos, right? Why? Because of this, essentially. Okay, so this charged pion here will decay to an E plus, plus nu plus nu mu bar. Okay, so here we have these three neutrinos that we should find. Okay, and so the existence of these extragalactic, probably extragalactic sources of high energy protons also imply that we should find extragalactic sources of high energy neutrinos. And one way to identify these cosmic accelerators is by seeing the neutrinos that they produce. Okay, just want to give you a couple numbers. Based on these numbers, we can immediately estimate, okay, what the neutrino intensity should be. So suppose that the sources put out this energy in proton, and suppose that even a large fraction goes to the neutrino. Okay, so then the neutrino intensity, okay, again, so this is C over 4 pi times the energy density in the neutrinos. Okay, now the energy density in the neutrinos is given by the rate of production of neutrino energy times the time over which these neutrinos are produced. Now, contrary to these high energy cosmic rays that have finite lifetime, they lose their energy. These neutrinos almost do nothing, they just redshift. So we should put here the Hubble time, okay? Not the cosmic ray lifetime. So we immediately see that this is the Hubble distance times the cosmic ray distance times the cosmic ray flux if the energy production rate of cosmic rays and neutrinos in the sphere is the same. So I'll put here epsilon dot nu as the value of epsilon dot cosmic ray. Now, if we are looking for muon neutrinos, which is the thing to look for, these take roughly one quarter of the energy that is carried by the pions, because roughly half the time you produce these neutral pions that don't produce neutrinos, and these two neutrinos take roughly half the energy of the charged pion. So this is roughly one quarter Hubble distance divided by cosmic ray distance times the cosmic ray flux. Okay? And we can immediately estimate this number. Okay? So we have one quarter. This, we said, is 10 to the 28 to 10 to the 26, so it's 100. And the cosmic ray flux, we've already done this. 10 to the 8, actually, I will use GeV here instead of ergs, because this is the common unit. So 10 to the 20 electron volts is 10 to the 11 GeV, and 10 to the 1200 kilometers squared in a year is 3 times 10 to the 7. So I hope you get the right number. This is 10, 21, and this is 13, we get 10 to the minus 8 GeV per square centimeter second stride. Excellent. Right number. So this is the flux of neutrinos that you might expect. The way that these neutrinos are looked for, as Francis would have told you, in order to detect very high energy muons, you need to realize that at PV energies, the range of these muons in matter, in rock or ice or whatever, water, is about a kilometer. Okay? So suppose that I have a neutrino coming in, okay, this is the Earth, okay, you know, goes through the Earth, and then let's say that this is the neutrino mean free path for interaction in the Earth, which may be larger than the Earth, and let's say that this is the muon range, okay. So if the neutrino interacted within a muon range from your detector, you would see the muon. Okay? So the probability that you would neutrino will produce a mu neutrino detector is lambda mu divided by lambda mu, which is roughly 10 to the minus 6 e units of EV. Okay? It doesn't grow faster because the cross-section, you're already above the W mass in the center of mass of the interaction. So this is why it doesn't grow faster than the energy here. Okay, so if we have the flux and we have the probability, we can know how many neutrinos we will have in a given size of detector. So we can estimate the size of the detector that, that we need. Okay, so let's do this. So the rate of neural detection in your detector, okay, is this J, let's say you have a 2 pi detector, so it's 2 pi times J mu, but this is in energy, so I need to divide by the neutrino energy to get the number flux, and then I need to multiply by P mu mu times the effective area of my detector, okay? So. If you take a TeV, this is going to be 10 to the minus 7, and a TeV is 10 to the 3 GeV in TeV. We have 10 to the minus 6. And here I'll take the effective area of the detector in units of kilometers squared. So this is 10 to the 10. And we would get 10 to the minus 13, 10 to the minus 6. 10 to the minus 6, this is energy independent, okay, because the probability here is ETV. So 10 to the minus 6 A in kilometers per second, or if you want 30 A kilometers square events per year. Okay, so this tells you that you want to build a detector with an effective area of a kilometer square if you want to pick up this extragalactic neutrino signal, and this is what Francis and Doug and others are doing here, and this will be discussed this week in the conference. So there are a couple of efforts. So there is the Amanda detector in the South Pole. It's, let's say, roughly 0.1 kilometer square effective area. And this is currently expanded in the Ice Cube project. And this would be 1 kilometer square effective area. So we will have a chance to start picking up these extragalactic neutrinos. This would not only answer the hopefully, these questions of the high energy cosmic rays. One thing that I've just illustrated, you've seen that we have this, I've shown you this very simple model for the acceleration, but you don't really understand how this acceleration works in detail, and you don't understand the sources and so on. So these neutrino experiments, hopefully, will provide us with a new type of a handle to understand these very powerful cosmic accelerators. Now, in this context, I should mention that there are some efforts. So this is the South Pole. And there are some efforts in the Mediterranean. Antares is being built. It aims to be 0.1 kilometers squared. As you can see from this, it's too small. So they would enlarge it, hopefully. So there are other efforts in the Mediterranean. Nestor, NEMO, which is a research project, but R&D project. But the point is that they have already formed what they call a KM3 net. So this is a collaboration of all these efforts to produce 1 cubic kilometer detector in the Mediterranean. So we have 1 detector in the South Pole, 1 detector in the Mediterranean. We would see both the northern and southern hemisphere. Okay, I think I should stop. I'll be over time, but you can ask questions.
So I gather that that you, for example, believe that GRB is going to count to the high energy cosmic rays without being a part of the.
How did you get this conclusion? the reason I find it a bit difficult to believe this invoking new particles. There are several reasons, but one is if you look at the plots of the, let's say, the cosmic ray spectrum, suppose that this is the predicted spectrum that we have the suppression of the flux. And you look at the experimental data, so it looks pretty much okay up to this 10 to the 20, and then you think there are large overalls here. Not known. But suppose that I take the view that the higher energy points are the correct ones, and there's some discrepancy between the experiments, so I take this, okay? This would be, let's say, a factor of 3 times higher than this smooth model prediction. I find it very unnatural to postulate, you know, that, okay, we would still have to explain what produces the particles up to 10 to the 20, okay? And then for those above 10 to the 20, it would be some completely, entirely different physics with an energy generation rate which is like just twice the astrophysical one that we just derived. I don't like this. So I already said I shouldn't have this microphone.
Now, in this model, you also presumably make predictions about the photons from the
final figure. That's right. But as Peter has mentioned, the TV photons do not propagate much because there's an infrared background in the universe and they immediately produce electron-positron pairs, so they don't, it's hard to see them directly. If we have a very nearby source, maybe. Yeah.
Two questions.
Yeah.
One is, so the whole neutrino story is out the window if the primaries are heavy, is that correct?
No.
Okay, you don't produce nearly as many, I would imagine.
Right, so that two points. If there are two different issues here. One is when we derive this flux here,
yeah.
Okay, I've assumed that all the energy basically of these photons goes to the neutrinos.
Right, but if it's primaries, then you're dissociating.
If they are heavy ions,
sorry, if they're heavy, yeah.
If they're heavy nuclei, yeah. Then they would be dissociated. But this is only at the very highest energies for interaction with the cosmic microwave background. Mm-hmm. The same interactions should take place also in the sources themselves.
Okay.
And they should produce neutrinos, not at the 10 to the 19 electron volts, but at lower energy. Okay? So I think that these neutrinos must be there if these are baryonic accelerators of astrophysical accelerators of nuclei.
Okay. And the other thing is it easier to model acceleration for the heavier guys?
There are some advantages and some disadvantages. In this equation here, okay, if you remember, I assume that the charge is just electron charge.
Right.
If you have a larger charge, you should divide it by the charge of the particle. So in that sense, it becomes easier. On the other hand, higher charge particles suffer much faster energy losses by radiation, yeah. You know, quantum scattering, and so on. So it depends on the environment and the assumptions of the model. It may be or may not be easier. So it's you cannot make a statement that it's easier to accelerate a high charge particle to this energy. It depends on the difference of the model. Yeah.
It might not be for you, but is this the best, the most optimistic scenario for IceCube in terms of a signal?
I mean, 30 per kilometer square per year?
Is the best thing going for IceCube?
Well, I think it's...
You want me to answer it?
Yeah.
The answer is almost yes. I mean, because we have an AMANDA for 5 years of data that's been analyzed, and we're in blind analysis, so everything hasn't been unblinded. So I think we are roughly at a limit where IceCube cannot see anything that's more than 1,000 per year, events per year. But otherwise, we should have started seeing it.
So, yeah. So I told them this would be the case before they had this analysis. Felix.
Actually, I think it's cube squared could be some misleading, especially for people who is outside, because these are for for neutrinos, effective detection, as Francis said today also. So detection area is much, much smaller, 10 square centimeter or 100 square centimeter. And when people say cubic, that is the volume which occupied by detectors.
So this is...
Yeah, that is one.
So this is the effective area for the muons. And if you want to define an effective area for the neutrino, it would be this P times A, it would be much, much smaller.
Well, I want to say when talking about the detection area, is really misleading people outside, even especially when you say one
It doesn't matter.
Kilometers squared. It's important.
The number of events is what's important.
I think this is a question. This is a question.
Because if I want to get the detection rate, I should multiply flux to detection area. And then, I mean, I don't care anymore. So
this is because you're used to photons. You know, every photon that hits the detector is triggering. That's not the case for almost any particular server.
Okay, that's done.